Okay, good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to introduce Eddie Breuer, both on a professional and a personal level. Dr. Breuer, as I'm sure many of you know, grew up in Montreal and spent a number of years in Toronto in Thornhill, and as a resident of Thornhill, and a graduate of Harvard University with a doctorate. He taught at Penn, and he's been living in Israel for about 18 years.
Seven years.
I'm sorry. Whatever. Time flies or slow. I don't know what it is.
I don't know why you thought that.
Right. It feels like 18 years. His son is in the army now. So I guess that's always a point when one is Israeli. By the way, and Adam Persinger's son is also in the army. As we speak, but both of them. I think that's just it's worth mentioning, and it's a pleasure to have him here in Toronto. And without further ado, Dr. Breuer.
Thank you. I'll try by using. You hear me? Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to be here. Always. I think I've even used. I'm not amplified.
No.
Well, someone else is okay. Is that better? Okay, thank you very much. Really, it is a pleasure. I look out and I recognize so many faces. It's always a little embarrassing, in fact. It always makes me feel what would have been were I have been chosen to be the high school valedictorian, which I wasn't. Was not anywhere serious enough in those days. But the idea of sort of speaking to all the parents and all the friends. So I guess this is my latter day attempt at doing that. I want to begin with really a self-reflective comment. It's sort of also where I want. And of course, in between the beginning comments and the end comments, I'm supposed to say something about Hirsch, which I will. But the comment is, as Jay introduced me, what I do professionally, what I do for a living is, is academic Jewish studies, which is to say Jewish studies is studied in a university context with free, open, critical approaches to texts. And there's a fair question to ask about the relationship between, call it critical or academic Jewish studies, and the lives that we live as Jews, which is to say, what impact or relationship, or perhaps none at all, we have to be fair here and open-ended, should the academic pursuit of Jewish studies have on our own, not our own personal identity, but our identity as communities? What does it do to the way in which we study texts? What does it do to the way in which we think of ourselves as Jews and think of ourselves as what kind of Jewish community we want to build, what kind of questions we want to ask, what kind of questions we want our children to ask? Etc., etc. Because I do this professionally, I think that every once in a while it's useful for me, and I think for all of us, to sort of think about the relationship between that kind of academic study and the lives that we live as Jews. So that's my opening comment, and I certainly want to get back to that when towards the end of the comments. The question is what this has to do with Hirsch. And I, what I have to do now is try to show you that this was very much an issue, I think an issue of concern to Harav Samson Raphael Hirsch. I begin with the 19 letters. It's the very first thing that Samson Raphael Hirsch published in 1936 at the young age of 28. Certainly already then made his remark. It is a remarkable text. I think one has to appreciate the 19 letters in context. I think in my other talks, perhaps I will, the one this afternoon, I could speak to that a bit more. It certainly created a buzz. It created a buzz. Here's a text written in German and clearly intended as a text, highly accessible, I think, to your average German Jewish reader. But it is one that made an argument for the preservation of tradition, bottom line. There are a couple of interesting lines I want to sort of draw out of the 19 letters. So let me sort of share those lines with you, and then let's sort of ponder what they may be getting at, and then I'll move further in it. You know that the letters, for those of you who are familiar with the 19 letters, they are fictitious letters. The first one written from Benjamin to Naftali, And all the others, 18 letters of response from Naftali back to Benjamin. Naftali is Hirsch. That's the pseudonym that he has taken on. And ostensibly, the context here is two friends who kind of grew up together and then went off on their own ways. When I say went off on their own ways, I mean went off on their own ways. One clearly drifted away and abandoned traditional Jewish practice, and Naftali remains traditional. They meet seemingly in some train station, each one waiting for their train so that they couldn't really finish the conversation. And all the letters are now Naftali, Benjamin writing to Naftali, "It was so nice to see you, Naftali, but I really don't understand how you could remain traditional, given your openness and your open-mindedness and what a cultured individual you are." And basically Naftali takes all the other letters as a chance to respond to that. So it's an explanation, if you will, not an apology necessarily, perhaps not at all, but an explanation of why he remains traditional, why it is so important to remain traditional, etc., and how one can in fact remain traditional even in early 19th century Germany. In the very first of the letters that Naftali writes, he says to Benjamin, he says, "Look, as we begin this discourse, if you will, this conversation, it's one way, but still imagined as something of a conversation, how should we approach the question? Let's first talk about approach, and then we can talk about the question. Since we must pick up the Torah, and from the Torah we must learn the history of Judaism. But," and I'm quoting here directly, "before we open it, let us consider how we shall read it. Let us not read it for the purpose of conducting philological and antiquarian investigations, or to find support and corroboration for the antediluvian or geological hypotheses, etc., etc., etc. Rather, it is as Jews that we must study the Torah." Now, what question is what he meant when he said this? I jump ahead to the 18th letter to try to reinforce this a little bit and to give flesh to the point. In the 18th letter, he is giving something of a summary, if you will, of Jewish history, of the history of Judaism. He comes to the era of Judeo-Arabic culture. And of course, who's the great hero in the era of Judeo-Arabic culture? It is the Rambam, Maimonides. And again, this is predictable. He says that age gave birth to a man, a great man. This is, of course, again, the Rambam, who was compelled to reconcile in his own manner the conflict which raged within his own breast, and who, by proclaiming it to the world, became the guide of all in whom the same conflict existed. Now, what is the conflict? The conflict is seemingly between Judaism and the broader culture, in this case, Arabic culture, which stimulated him and challenged him, and Hirsch uses the word here, interestingly, as conflict. "To this great man and to him alone do we owe the preservation of practical Judaism down to our day." And he continues here. "Because he sought to reconcile Judaism with the difficulties which confronted it from without, from outside, instead of developing it creatively from within, he is responsible for all the good which blesses the heritage of modern Judaism, as well as for the evil that afflicts it." Okay, now this is Hirsch talking about the Rambam. And what was the issue here? I just skipped one line. "He," meaning the Rambam, "entered into Judaism from without." The Rambam came to Judaism from Arabic culture into Judaism. He was importing, internalizing a foreign culture. And Hirsch doesn't mince his words here. Again, it's the great blessing and the great evil, quoting his words, which afflict it. Very stark comment. Just one last comment here, reinforcing very much what we're saying. As he moves on in the history of Judaism, undoubtedly he gets to his own era, meaning the German-Jewish era. And there, writing in the 1830s, when he's reflecting backwards as to when the great German-Jewish era begins, who, of course, is he going to reflect on? Moses Mendelssohn, unquestionably. He thinks here of the great figures in Jewish history. It's the Rambam and Moses Mendelssohn. And again, I quote, "When the external yoke began to grow lighter and the spirit felt freer, there arose again a brilliant personality who inspired great respect. This was Moses Mendelssohn, who, by his commanding influence, had led the latter development up to this very day. The later development, up to this very day. This commanding individual, who had not drawn his mental development from the wellsprings of Judaism, was great chiefly in philosophical disciplines, in metaphysics and aesthetics. He studied the Bible only from the philological and aesthetic point of view. He did not build up Judaism as a science within itself. So you notice now exactly the same criticism, and this is indeed true. Hirsch, in other words, looks at, you know, what could be seemingly his great heroes from previous eras, the Rambam and Mendelssohn, and says both were great individuals, great personalities, and both had a flaw. Maybe it's that great, you know, every great figure has some kind of a flaw. What is their flaw? That their inspiration came from without. It came from outside Judaism. And this is his one major criticism against Mendelssohn, and it's the same criticism he delivers against the Rambam too. I think this should help us understand now what he had said earlier. He's somehow struggling in these 19 letters to say, I don't want something from the outside to define what Judaism is. Judaism has to be defined from the inside and from within. Okay, so this is point number one that I wanted to make here. Now, when we ask, again, thinking as a historian, what's bothering him? What exactly is he saying? I want to point out that in the 1830s, when he writes the 19 letters, you should realize that, of course, this is a book that takes a position anti-reform, but really what it's doing is taking a position pro-tradition, pro-Masoret. Reform in the 1830s was not really a fully developed ideological movement. Really not at all. That came in the 1840s. So it's not quite right to make the major focus of his attack here Reform Judaism. And what I'd like to suggest, in fact, there is something that does bother him. And what is bothering him is the beginning of something we call Wissenschaft des Judentums, the beginning of the science of Judaism. The academic, critical study of Judaism. That did already begin as early as 1818, 1819, in the writings of Zuntz, in the Verein, in this cultural this group that formed in Berlin in 1819 and was active for a few years in the 1820s. We have Zuntz, who's already publishing, Isaac Yost, a great Jewish historian, and of course, Abraham Geiger. All of these were individuals who were already putting pen to paper and beginning to publish and to write. And they, in fact, were the ones who were beginning to develop what we would call sort of academic Jewish studies. I would propose, in other words, and we began by reading the 19 letters and seeing Hirsch kind of resist this read, that I think what's going on here is a struggle for exactly this. What worries him at this point is just that, is this new kind of approach that he sees. He sees the Rambam was guilty of it too. Mendelssohn was guilty of it too. But now it's starting in deeper way in earnest. It is on one hand the same problem that the others have had, and he's trying to propose a different approach. But I would also suggest that he appreciates that there is a connection, and he fully well intuits correctly, that there is a connection between this new sort of academic critical approach, what we could call here in shorthand Jewish studies, and the religious reforms that are beginning to develop as well. In other words, the way in which you approach and think about these texts, and by taking this new outside approach, if you will, approach drawn from general culture, it will have an impact. And basically what Hirsch is doing in the 19 letters is saying, no, I want to resist this. I want to resist this. Now, how successfully he truly resists drawing from the outside is a very fair question, and frankly, I admit to you that I'm skeptical about this. There's enough of romanticism that's coursing through Hirsch and Hegelian strands that course through Hirsch, which tell you that Hirsch was not living in a vacuum. That's not possible, and Hirsch is as quote-unquote guilty of that, if you will, as the others that he accuses. But there still is something of a resistance that is taking place here. Now, what is it a resistance against? Again, let's just go back for a moment to people like Geiger. What is the scholarship that is taking place in the 1830s? Well, it's a scholarship that's very interested in language and interpretation, particularly in rabbinic interpretation. One of the questions that Geiger and the others are beginning to ask in the 1830s is, how exactly did Chazal read Mikra? What were their methods and their approaches? What, as a particular issue here, is the relationship between the Mishnah and the Midrash? Mishnah, of course, as you know, from your studies, is not in overtly interested in Mikra, in Scripture. It's simply laying out the Halakha as edited and redacted by Yehuda Hanasi. Midrash, on the other hand, is very much focused on and is grappling with, seemingly, Mikra. By asking the question of what comes first, what comes second, may one have developed from the other, you end up making some very important comments about what? About the development of Judaism. It's exactly, of course, what Geiger was interested in. It's exactly what many of these scholars were interested in, Tzuds, Yost as well. Again, as young, and they were all young at this point, historians, their premise is that Judaism does not stand still, that Judaism develops, and that it always had developed, and they're beginning to ask those critical scholarly questions about how, and what kind of evidence for this do we see in Sifrut Chazal, in rabbinic literature. So this is already going on by the time Hirsch puts pen to paper and publishes this. And I think Hirsch, quite frankly, senses here a danger and starts building a resistance. Now let me move ahead a little bit in in Hirsch's writings. Some of you may know, it's interesting, he and Geiger, and Abraham Geiger, actually studied together at the University of Bonn for a year. They knew each other, they were even chavrutas, it seems, briefly. They go their own way. At the end of the 30s, and actually in reaction to the 19 letters, a young fellow by the name of Heinrich Gretz gets so enthused by reading Hirsch, he shows up, almost quite literally, I think, at Hirsch's doorstep, and makes himself something of a Talmud, if you will, of Hirsch. He hangs around for a few years. Eventually, Gratz leaves and goes his own way. He teaches history in Breslau at the seminary of Zacharia Frankel. Zacharia Frankel is somebody who clearly does not consider himself Orthodox, now that the term in the mid-19th century is being used, although Frankel also distanced himself from Geiger and the Reformers. The point is that you have a number of individuals here. Again, these are names you should know: Geiger, Gretz, Frankel, all of whom are seen as other, as, you know, thinking of a Judaism in ways that are unacceptable to Hirsch and to this sort of coalescing orthodoxy, as it will. Gretz begins to publish in 1853 his History of the Jews. Now, the fact that Gretz left Hirsch doesn't leave good feelings between them, and no sooner than Gretz begins publishing than Hirsch puts pen to paper and starts writing a series of articles, scathing articles, just tearing into Gretz. In other words, he takes Gretz's History of the Jews, particularly, surprise, surprise, the volume on Chazal, on rabbinic literature, and just really goes at it. Now, I have to say, Hirsch, in some ways, does justice here, which is to say, he accuses Gretz of being subjective, arbitrary, inaccurate, quick to generalize, superficial, pretty much every other devastating critique one can think of. And there's a lot to what Hirsch is saying. There's no question about that. But what's interesting here is that, again, he takes this attack by showing just how ridiculous Gretz is in drawing the various conclusions. One thing that Hirsch doesn't do, interestingly enough, is sort of get at the question of, okay, well, what is history? Or what should history be used for? Or what might more accurate or positive uses of this kind of critical approach be? That he doesn't do. Again, he simply seems content to highlight the distortions and the unreliable nature of Gretz's reconstructions. A few years after that, Zacharia Frankel, this is the same Frankel that we talked about before, publishes an important book called Darchei HaMishnah. This is Frankel's introduction to the Mishnah. It appears in 1859, if I didn't already mention that. And no sooner than that comes out, and you know what's coming. Now, Hirsch already had his journal Yeshurun, where he published his attacks on Gretz. It's very important, as you know, communication is key. And having an outlet, so to speak, a means of broadcasting your thoughts and feelings and critiques is very important. Hirsch had his own in-house journal, so it's very easy for him to sort of get his message out. He becomes aware of a Hungarian Rav, a fellow by the name of Rav Fischer, and who's written in Hebrew a critique of Frankel's book. And Hirsch basically translates it into German and prints it. And then he adds a number of his own notes, on top of Fisher, meaning his own critique of Frankel, and then a further critique of a man named Rabbi Rappaport, Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport, who is the chief rabbi in Prague, who also happens to be a Rav with very sort of, you know, open and critical kinds of approaches as well. Rappaport had dared, in Hirsch's eyes, to come to the defense of Frankel. Okay, so just so that you understand sort of the individuals here. And Hirsch is critical then of Rappaport, he's critical of Frankel, and he sort of, again, as I said, launches into a string of articles. What's interesting here, when you look at this whole sort of attack on Frankel, now, what was it that bothered them about Frankel? And it's very interesting to see here. Frankel, again, speaks about certain developments in Torah Sheba Alpeh, in our rabbinic tradition. You know already people are going to be very sensitive to this. Frankel seemed to be quite content to say, look, we have certain ancient traditions. And then he picks up the picture where those ancient traditions are being reformulated and then showing developments from the Sofrim through the Mishnah and the Tosefta, etc., etc. Hirsch, like this Rav Fischer, are reading it with, I think, hypersensitive ideological antennae. And they keep saying over and over again, there's one thing missing in Frankel's writings. And that is a statement that Torah Sheba'al Peh comes from Sinai. That's what we want to hear. Now, what's going on here is funny. Frankel doesn't address the point. The fact that he doesn't address the point is exactly what they seize on. They sort of snatch it and grab it and say, yaha, you see? He's a dangerous man. He's a dangerous man because he doesn't really believe that Torah Sheba'al Peh comes from Sinai. Even though Frankel didn't say yes, didn't say no, didn't say whatever. So they sort of go after him ideologically. The truth is, what Rappaport did when he came to Frankel's defense, again, Rappaport is an Orthodox Rav. Rappaport comes and he comes to defend Frankel by saying, listen, you know, you're taking something of a, you know, those who would attack Frankel, because again, Rappaport already saw the attack, are taking too blunt of an instrument. Frankel is nuanced. He's doing a nuanced kind of scholarship. You have to give him credit for some of the nuances and the distinctions that he's trying to introduce. They also point out that in certain cases, Frankel quite easily has certain rishonim, certain medieval precedents that he could rely on. He's not just making things up. He's not just coming out with this. But again, what's interesting here is that Rappaport's attempt at kind of nuancing and realizing, you know, there's certain critical perspectives you have to appreciate, that even the rishonim appreciated certain developments in Torah Sheba'al Peh, in our oral tradition. Hirsch would have none of this. Again, he simply over and over again sort of reiterates the fact that I don't want these niceties. I want an ideological statement that is unambiguous. And again, you see here a kind of attention. Again, it is Frankel who comes from the school, if you will, of historical critical scholarship, a la Geiger, a la others, although again, he and Geiger would not agree on very much at all. And Hirsch, again, really draws a line here. In this case, he's saying that all these niceties won't do it. I want ideologically clear statements, and that's what interests me. And anything that falls short is dangerous. Moving along in his writings to something that was advertised in the title for this talk, so I should certainly say something about it. In any event, I would like to say something about it. And that has to do with Hirsch's commentary to the Chumash. Hirsch publishes his commentary in 1867. This appears between 1867 and 1878. So we ask ourselves the question. By this point, by the time you get to the 1860s, there's another field that has been quite well developed at this point. It's not fully developed, but it's begun, and that's called biblical criticism. Really already from the end of the 18th century. The question of how Jews responded to this is a whole other talk. I will not give you that today. I'll be actually giving that at JTS on Wednesday. So in a very different context, I get to talk about very different kinds of things. Well, what do you find in Hirsch's commentary? Well, here I have to say I'm going to rely on a descendant of Hirsch, Rav Mordechai Breuer, who in a 1993 article in Machanaim, I think, is the one who put it almost the clearest and the best. Okay? And again, this is, by the way, the work that I think is most accessible. I assume most of us sitting in this room have at one point or another, you know, leafed through or studied or have been exposed to Hirsch's commentary. Point number one, obviously, is Hirsch does not use any of the modern critical, does not raise the modern critical questions, does not even refer to them, not even to critique them or to undermine them. Fair enough, he's not interested in that. Well, what is he interested in? And what Rav Breuer says, I think, so sweetly and nicely, and only he can say it as a descendant really as a great-grandson of Rav Hirsch, is that it's also not a book that you find much by the way of Pshuto Shel Mikra. It's not a book that's interested in Pshat. It's a book that is driven by ideas. And those ideas don't always have any bearing, frankly, I think Breuer says in his nice way, on the text. One nice way of saying this is that what Hirsch does is give us a 19th century midrash. Fair enough. To a large degree, I think that is true. The words that Breuer actually uses, he says, in Hirsch's writings, you see something beautiful. And he's saying this obviously to find a way of complimenting Hirsch on this. There really is something beautiful. There's a certain beauty and even a poetry, if you will, in the ideas that he's spinning. But as Rav Breuer puts it so delicately, beauty is therefore something that is above and beyond saying it's correct or incorrect. There's not here, and let's go even further. What is Hirsch really, what is his technique, if you will, more often than not? It's these kind of what he calls speculative etymologies, right? He's comparing shorashim, roots. This word is related to that word, and it's related to that word, that word, that word, and that word. Okay? You sit down, and I ask occasionally, and I even sat a few weeks ago with a young Bible scholar, and somehow this came up in conversation, and you say to them, what do you do with this? And frankly, the response is, you don't know what to do with this. Because, again, it's wonderful, it's speculative, it is imaginative, but it doesn't seem to have a basis in any Semitic language that we know. Okay? Not Hebrew, unfortunately. Again, it's unfortunate, but it's true. Again, and to this day, I think Bible scholars don't quite know what to do with it. Because, again, you need to have, even in the broadest way, of course, one could argue, look, study Semitic languages. After all, Hebrew is a Semitic language. It is related to other ancient Semitic languages. And in this way, we do learn even some very interesting things about the Shorashim, about what words actually mean. Fine, you don't necessarily have to be a scholar of Akkadian, Sumerian, etc. So you could narrow the gap and say, well, let's just deal with Tanakh. Just, you know, the 24 books of Tanakh and deal in that way. To be honest with you, again, Hirsch seems here to really break with a very long, rich tradition of Pashtanim. Even Rashi would be included here, of course, Rashbam and Ibn Ezra and others who've done some excellent work. And, you know, there's a sense in which what words mean. But Hirsch, in this case, is not really interested in that. He really, genuinely is not interested in that. He breaks the bounds here, works, I think, in a very, again, very creative and fanciful way, but it's very hard to know what to do with it. Because, again, you spin beautiful ideas, but the relationship of those ideas to the text leave you really, in this case, with some very fair questions. I think Rav Sherlo was again quoted recently, although I have no doubt that Rav Sherlo took this from Rav Breuer to say, if you want beauty, you look at Hirsch. And I'm making a comment now, I'll come back to it a little bit later. And if you want truth, you look at Rav David Zvi Hoffman. In other words, there are certain people you look for truth, and certain other people you look for beauty. What actually is interesting here, in a recent book by a fellow named Ran HaKohen, I should just forgot the title in Hebrew. The book only exists in Hebrew at this point, basically on biblical scholarship and criticism in the 19th century. He points out that Hirsch's son-in-law, Rav Yosef Guggenheimer, who was a Rav in Bohemia, that his son-in-law, just as Hirsch was beginning to publish his Chumash in 1867, published a series of articles in Yeshurun, Hirsch's journal, titled Biblical Critical Hypotheses and the Commentary of Hirsch. So it's his son-in-law, to some degree, who gets relegated a couple of essays, who basically says, and again, it's interesting to look at and to think about, who says something along these lines. He says, look, first of all, what we really have in Hirsch is sort of dogma contra dogma. What is the dogma of the biblical critics, Guggenheimer claims? Well, they simply deny revelation. They deny that the Torah is a divinely revealed text. What does Hirsch do? He says the Torah is a divinely revealed text. Those are two dogmatic statements. It is not science versus science, it's dogma versus dogma. Fair. Point number one. He certainly also denies, as again, I think many Bible scholars, biblical scholars have to do, perforce, is sort of take up the question of, well, is the Bible literature like other literatures, and can we employ the same set of tools, techniques, etc.? Guggenheimer says, no, there cannot be a comparison between biblical literature and other literatures. Again, because his first dogmatic statement is that it is a divinely revealed text, therefore it cannot be like any other literature, and therefore he, you know, from premise one or point one, he moves on to point two. What actually is really interesting here, and here I have to thank my friend Hanan Gafni for this insight. Hanan Gafni, I will point out to you, is a sixth-generation descendant of Samson Raphael Hirsch. He's actually a good friend, and we actually work together, and he sits next to me in the National Library. And so it's interesting to have this angle as well, of someone who sort of comes from within the family. But he says in a few of the comments that Guggenheimer makes, again, one of the issues, I'm doing this in shorthand, I realize, and it's not entirely fair, but one of the issues, of course, that biblical scholars by the 1860s are beginning to sort of already not only think about, but grapple with and develop, is the question of either the sources of the Bible, meaning if it's drawn from different sources and then woven together, source criticism, or even the notion of, that the Bible represents a series of fragments which a biblical editor much later than tradition would suppose wove together. That already begins in the beginning of the 19th century. Guggenheimer sort of says, and he uses the example of the relationship between Bereshit Aleph and Bereshit Bet, right? Of course, the two names of God is an issue, and the very different creation story that is relayed there. And effectively, what Hanan Gafni says, and again, very insightful, is that what Guggenheimer is doing is something that the Rav Breuer who just passed away a few years ago, has done, which is to say that there's a very easy, traditional way of understanding differences between Bereshit Aleph and Bet, between any two biblical texts that may appear to somehow rub up against each other, that may be supposed to be representing or reflecting different fragments or different sources. They simply represent different perspectives. Different perspectives on God, different perspectives on what creation is, different, you know, one might be focused on the morality of mankind and the other one on a more, you know, sort of, a perspective, you know, that may not be as focused as mankind, as on the structure of the universe or et cetera, et cetera. The point here simply is that Rav Breuer has made, and those who studied in the Gush, in Yeshivat Har Etzion may know this, made a great career of what they call the Shitat HaBechinot, the sort of looking, basically using the tools and even sometimes conclusions of modern biblical critical scholarship, but turning it around and saying, well, actually, that's right. They certainly are right to notice that there are texts here that don't work together. Certainly, you shouldn't sort of go about harmonizing them in some kind of a false way. After all, that's forcing the issue. But rather appreciate that the different texts just simply represent different angles, different aspects of insight into, again, God, God's relationship with mankind, etc., etc., etc. So it's interesting that Guggenheimer's piece, right when Hirsch publishes, may already kind of be read as a way of fending off, if you will, or addressing some critical questions there. Again, it's a supposition, but basically, it's interesting Hanan Gafni was trying to say is that Rav Breuer wasn't as original as he thought. He actually took it from someone else in the family about three generations before. Okay. Now, I want to move, one second, in a different direction. What I've said so far simply is that Hirsch is not interested in sort of this, you know, we'll call it the beginnings of Jewish studies in the 19th century. He's quite hostile to it. He sees it as a threat. And in all his writings, he's either critiquing it or ignoring it, etc. I hope I've made that case, and I think this is actually fairly straightforward. The question now for us to ask is that, so what are we left with? Is that the only model or the only, the only model from 19th century German Orthodoxy that we may carry away? Some of you here are aware, so I will use the opportunity to remind you and to perhaps teach others who aren't aware that there was a fellow by the name of Rav Azriel Hildesheimer. Hirsch was not the only Orthodox Rav in Germany. It's very important to remember there were many Orthodox Rabbanim. Hildesheimer, really in this case, really becomes something of a counterbalance, if you will, or another perspective on what to do. Now, without giving you the whole biography, Hildesheimer was born in Halberstadt. He was born in 1820, so he's 12 years younger than Samson Fall Hirsch. He has a very different kind of career. He ended up as a Rav in Eisenstadt, which is within the Habsburg Austrian Empire and within sort of shooting distance, if you will, of the sphere of the Chatam Sofer. And this became an issue because in Hildesheimer's yeshiva, Hildesheimer was a modern man who in his yeshiva wanted to include some secular subjects and study of Dikduk and other issues, and he had no end of grief for this. But in 1869, Azriel Hildesheimer is invited to Berlin. He's invited to Berlin to take over a community that was not unlike Hirsch's own separatist community in Frankfurt. It's the Adas Yisrael in Berlin. He comes in 1869, and part of the deal is that he will be the Rav of this Shul, which is a community, and also the Beit Midrash. Now he'll take over kind of as Rosh Beit Midrash, and he comes, and within a few years, he already says, I have a different vision. I have a different idea. I want a new modern rabbinic seminary. And the truth is, when you ask yourself, well, where does the idea of training rabbis or a modern idea of training rabbis that are suitable to the modern era come from, at least within the Orthodox context, because at this point, Reform had already, and Zacharia Frankel, this other middle movement, had already founded their own seminaries. Well, basically, Hildesheimer comes to Berlin and says, Higiazman, the time has come, we need a modern seminary. And he founds one. In 1873, he opens then the Rabbiner Seminar in Berlin. Hirsch was very against this. Okay, and what I'm getting at now is I want you to realize that there's serious tension that emerges between Frankfurt and Hirschian Orthodoxy and basically what became Berlin and Hildesheimer Orthodoxy as well. Why? Because Hildesheimer insisted. First of all, of course, the meat and potatoes of his rabbinic seminary would be Talmud and Poskim. Everyone would sit and study Gemara and Poskim. He would teach us. He was a major, serious Talmud Chacham. There's no question here. We have his Tshuvot. We have many of his writings. So, A, we have the meat and potatoes. But that's not enough for the training of young rabbis. And it was expected that everybody who studies in the rabbinic seminary, it was a 5-year program. Although if you weren't prepared enough, there were a couple of extra years. If you were more advanced, you could skip those years. But everyone was expected to do a doctorate at the University of Berlin at the same time, parallel to the yeshiva study. And in fact, in those years when you were working on your dissertation, you were given a patur, an allowance. You were let go from certain classes at the yeshiva, so there was an accommodation made. But even aside from the fact that he wanted all his students to study at the University of Berlin, he himself insisted that within the yeshiva, within this rabbinic seminary, to introduce important subjects, which he did, on Tanakh, on Parshanut, etc., precisely to expose these young students, if you will, to modern critical approaches. Now, Hildesheimer, honestly, I mean, he knew where he stood ideologically and made it very clear that the Torah is paramount, that nothing would in any way touch the divinity of the Torah and put into question either Torah Shebichtav or Torah Shebaalpeh. That said, he said, our young rabbis and our faculty, in fact, he was part of the faculty, Rav David Zvi Hoffman was hired onto the faculty, would be individuals who could not block, run away from, or negate these kinds of critical approaches, but rather would show mastery in those scientific critical approaches. Why? Because that's the way in which we could fight them. What's really going on here, of course, is a question of how do we deal with that whole new intellectual academic realm? Do you ignore it and simply say, verboten? Or do you say, no, we're going to train our students in that, and we're going to deal with it. Now, how we deal with it? Okay, that's a question. And you know fully well, of course, that the criticism against Hildesheimer that came out of the Hirschian school was a criticism saying, you're playing with fire. You don't realize where this is going to take you. You don't realize the implications of this. Nevertheless, this became a serious but substantive machloket, if you will, within German Orthodoxy. So in other words, it's important, I think, for us to sort of realize, again, this is a conference on Hirsch, not Hildesheimer. It's important to realize in this regard what Hirsch leaves us with, which is, again, we have to be honest here about the different clientele as well. Hirsch was really a leader of a community of Balabatim. That's what he wanted. He wanted to simply reinforce this community and its ideological underpinnings, if you will. There's no question that what Hildesheimer was after, even though he was a rav of the community, was the training not of rabbis. He was here looking at the elite, at the cream, at the leadership. And he simply felt that we need certain kinds of rabbis here. So obviously they're speaking to different audiences, they're speaking to different concerns. Flipping it back, of course, I have to point out that Hirsch never did found a rabbinic seminary. Not only that, to be honest with you, he never even founded a yeshiva. That was left to his son-in-law, Rav Shlomo Breuer, who did it only in 1891 after Hirsch had already passed away. So, you know, Hirsch's focus was not, so to speak, on higher education. Hirsch's focus was not in dealing with this. He wanted to very much fend it off and say, this is not for us. This is not for us. And again, part of it is this, you know, deep ideological stance that I mentioned in the 19 letters. It's a sense that modern critical approaches are just another way of being defined from without, being defined from the outside. We cannot do that. We Jews read the Torah, not as critical scholars, but as Jews. We read it with heart, and we read it with emotion, and we read it with, you know, the ideas that we want to carry away. Again, Hildesheimer simply felt, and this crowd in Berlin felt that that was either naive or too simplistic, that we have to worry not only about Balabatim and that kind of community, we truly have to think about where the next generation of scholars would be trained and how they would be trained, etc. Now, where does that leave us? So this is the chance to sort of pull back into the 21st century. And again, I think my point, I hope, was clear. That German Orthodoxy, leaves us with a few different models that are available to us. Hirsch is really only one. And I think, honestly, this is why I titled this the challenge unanswered, is that Hirsch, to a large degree, never really dealt with the issues. He simply puts up a certain blockade, if you will, and says no. The question that we have to sort of think about in reflecting is that good enough? Maybe it is. I'm fully well aware, and I say this openly, and I say this to invite your response is not to what only I said about Hirsch, but for all of us to think together that I think we still struggle with this today. I really think we do. I think we still don't quite know what to do with academic Jewish studies and where it could somehow fit in to our Orthodox communities. We really don't. I feel that on my own skin, so to speak, in a very personal way, because I know different people react in different ways to the kinds of things that I and my colleagues engage in. Some of it, of course, is a personal comfort level. But some of it is very much a discussion of, well, what's good for our communities? What do people need? Perhaps critical approaches are not helpful. They're only going to raise questions and create confusion, etc. And that, of course, is one very legitimate approach. But, of course, there is the countervailing perspective as well, which is to say, aren't we looking here to maximize sophistication? And frankly, in this case, being aware of all kinds of very interesting discourse that is out there, ways of reading texts, dealing with historical issues that may arise, and being honest about what those issues do and how they may impact on the way in which we read Mikra, Tanakh, Chazal, etc., etc., remains, I think, still very much an issue and a question. I'll just throw one last point out here. I certainly want to open this up to you a little bit, which is that I'm also very self-conscious of the fact, coming from Israel and standing in a North American context, that even this very issue is handled differently, I think. Let me not say negative things or critical things about Jews and Orthodox Jews in North America, but I have to tell you that in Israel there is, obviously within certain circles, something of much more of a comfortable blurring, let's say, maybe that's the best word I could use, blurring of lines between traditional ways of study and sort of academic and critical ways of study. I think there's not even as much tension about this. I think different people go different routes. There are some wonderful institutions. Interestingly enough, Matan, which is of course dedicated to the it's for women and for women's sort of an institute of higher study for women, where it's one of the interesting places where you actually have a very interesting mix of both the very traditional approaches to texts and yet very sort of academic, critical approaches that are introduced by a series of lecturers and Ramim there. There are any number of, you know, of rabbis who both go to Bar Ilan or elsewhere and do PhDs in Talmud and do PhDs. And again, there's this sort of this exposure to and this willingness to engage, I think, the, you know, the academic critical study and to somehow integrate it without sort of getting into the sort of deep ideological tensions and just simply doing it, I think, in a natural way. Again, where this leads and what it gives us is an open question. I don't presuppose that, but I think somehow in Israel there's something dynamic, and I think it's to some degree less, you know, ideologically sensitive, our sensitivity in the way in which this is now being broached. Okay, it's 11:10, so let me allow for some minutes of questioning and or feedback. I'm obviously interested in your comments. I want to thank Jay and Elliot too. I should take the opportunity for the invitation. The floor is open.
First of all, thank you very much. It was wonderful. You began by saying that Hirsch essentially regarded as the integrity and eternality of the Torah as its primary method of entry, and he didn't want to engage it through etymology and aesthetics, and yet by the end of our discussion, that's what we primarily see him as doing. How did that happen, and was he aware of the irony?
Before you answer, I suggest, because the time is short, we'll take a few questions, then we can answer them sort of a
while. Oh, okay. Well, then I have to remember what I was asked. You're presupposing. Thank you. Okay, I'll just try to... I don't even know how to...
etymology.
Right. Okay. Yes, sir.
Although I am very much against people who stand up and pontificate, I won't give a speech. I won't ask a question. Just want to say that thanks to people like Jay and Elliot, that we have we're trying to have somewhat of a blurring of those lines, as you call it, here in North America in Toronto. And I think they deserve a big round of applause.
I would not negate that. That's really what I... Well, just to address that. Honestly, I think the difference, if I may, between, I think, the Israeli context... Oh, sorry, okay.
Okay. One simple question. Yeah. Maybe you're really addressing this. Was Hirsch really intellectually honest or not?
Thank you, Ralph Kirstner. But let me be fair here. Was Ralph Hildesheimer honest? Intellectually honest. This cuts both ways. Again, I have to be fair here, and we have to be fair. Okay, but hold on. I'm sorry, that was too tempting to let go.
This might be too broad, but I was curious, when you talk about Hirsch being fanciful in his etymologies, is there any connection between him and Hasidut?
That's an interesting question. Okay, I think that spares me. Okay. okay, starting backwards, I guess, right? To address... Okay. His connection with Hasidut. There are those who... Right. Not right, I appreciate that. I think what you're sensitive to is that the next sessions begin, and I agree. First of all, that's an interesting question. There are those who try to sort of look at Hirsch and his relationship or his interest in Kabbalistic writings, in the Zohar. So that I'm aware of. Hasidut in particular, no. But I have to be honest with you, and this could be ignorance, and I concede that right up front. I don't know of Hasidut doing quite the same kinds of etymologies that he does. So I think there's something really unique here. Fair question. That's a fair question. I'm not actually sure how to answer that. I don't think so, but fair question. It's Ralph Kirzner. Again, the question of intellectual honesty, I think that cuts both ways. I think one would argue, for example, I had a quote here, and I don't think I brought it with, Alexander Altman, right, the great, you know, scholar. When he talked about Rav David Zvi Hoffman and the whole Hildesheimer Seminary in Berlin, basically said, that's not serious Jewish studies, it's just apologetics. They're using the critical approaches. But, you know, they're already, you know, the minute you set up lines and saying, well, we're gonna begin and end with the conclusion that the Bible is divinely revealed, and, you know, and Chazal, you know, the minute you and I are, you know, we would set out those kinds of criteria, and then we say, okay, but the approaches are going to make our appreciation of all that literature more sophisticated, you could claim that that's not intellectually honest, because we're sort of working within a framework. Of course, you could claim that it is, you know, that's exactly the issue. But again, for the purposes of here, it was simply, you could argue that Hirsch was most honest by saying, we cannot deal with this. And he was really honest then by criticizing even the Rambam. Okay, I view as a point of honesty. Because if you take a position in the 19th century on principle, and you're willing to even criticize the Rambam for that, I give him a lot of credit for that. Because he's sort of saying, again, it's very easy to idealize the Rambam and say he was, you know, the be-all and end-all, you know, and the problems only come later, or this and that. He's saying the Rambam fell to the same problem. He was willing to use intellectual constructs, intellectual ideas from outside that ended up defining his Judaism. Who, Hirsch? Yes, I agree. Now that leads to... I'm losing the questions here. But that's right. In other words, it's true that Hirsch, I think, liked to say, and there's, by the way, even here there's something of a rhetoric that goes back to Yehuda Halevi, the Kuzari, and Abarbanel. So there's something of a string here. Hirsch, he has good partners in this discussion, of Jews who say, you know, Judaism must be understood and defined only from within. The question is whether that's ever possible. Precisely with these kinds of thinking individuals who are extremely well-read. And that's right, there's an irony here. I think Hirsch, you know, would claim that he truly seized and articulated a true Judaism from within. And frankly, any of us, you know, I'd say reading it as a professional historian, it screams 19th century Germany. It is so influenced by everything around them. You know, to the point where it's almost dated. In other words, certain things just don't speak to me or, you know, to us. That's right. That was sort of, you could say it's either a blind spot, or you could say, look, it's an honest tension. What he's trying to do is just simply, you know, work away and realize that we're always being somehow defined from the outside, and that it's a problem. In this case, just wanting desperately to say, you know, I want to somehow see something genuine and untainted. Remember, that's what's really playing out here, because it's not affected by the way in which people read from the outside. So that, I think, addresses, I was trying to hook it on to that point. You're right, there are ironies here, and I think, you know, but I don't think early on Hirsch was negating the aesthetic as much as saying, you know, what I think he was referring to is kind of this very critical philological study. And therefore, what he was doing, he would say, is the right kind of philology, and they were doing the wrong kind of philology. You know, that's sometimes how you cut it.
Thank you very much for a very interesting talk, of course, and informative. I want to thank you. We'll be speaking again after lunch and on the panel. Right now, we'll take a 3-minute break. Mark Shapiro, right here, The Contested Legacy of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, Has He Been Accepted or Rejected? And in the hall, Dr. Huberger on the community in Frankfurt on Main, where, of course, Hirsch spent the better part of his career.